Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, am I audible? A little louder?
Maybe we can raise this.
This is called being strung up. Thank you. I've got a double purpose tonight. I'm going to at once try and fill you in some background in a very confusing issue, give you some of the very messy details, and also try and place the universities in their proper context in this kind of issue. First of all, let me outline the way I'm going to proceed. First, I'm going to argue that Arctic pipelines are important, not so much because of their vast scale, but because they are coming to the fore at a very special time in Canadian history, when a large number of issues are being rethought. And we will find these pipelines the focal point for a number of issues, which I'll list in a few minutes. Second, I'm going to illustrate with what I'm afraid you will find a vast and sleep-inducing array of figures, that industry and government, energy policies alike, have followed a seesaw pattern of overreactions to the past and underprovision for the future. Third, I'm going to show that as a consequence of the latest swing of the seesaw, the currently perceived shortages of natural gas have led to an agreement by industry and by the National Energy Board that Arctic gas is needed as soon as possible for Canadian use. I'll argue that these presumed shortages of natural gas are the result of the producers' desire to get quick access to the frontiers and the better tax and royalty treatment in the meantime. And the National Energy Board, on the other hand, is overreacting to a widespread and quite justified criticism of their 50% increase in long-term export commitments as recently as 1970. Thus, it appears likely, on the basis of these presumed shortages, that the falsely perceived urgency of current southern need will be used to justify a rather roughshod ride over future northern interests. Most importantly, the decision process is likely to be hastened so far as to push the decision ahead of the settlement of native land claims. Finally, having attempted to do that, I shall make some comments on the role of university-based research. I'll argue that universities have unique possibilities for performing independent research that can help to clarify issues and demonstrate the existence of less wasteful alternatives. What universities and their scholars have not yet faced very clearly is the extent of their obligation to present their research results to a broader audience, and hence to participate in public debate on public issues, a pastime for which most of us are singularly ill-equipped. Getting down to business, let me first list for you the major issues, broad issues, in context of which the pipeline debate is taking place. First of all, there is the question of big versus small. In technological terms, this is often regarded as the distinction between high technology and intermediate technology. In the consumption and use of resources, the new paradigm is the conserver society. These issues are, of course, faced with respect to other projects. Pickering and Mirabel are opposite sides of some aspects of that same question. The second issue is North versus South. Among white Northerners, the distinction may be drawn between newcomers and old-timers. Let me quote from one of the opening statements made to the Berger Commission on this question by the Northwest Territories Association of Municipalities. It emphasizes this issue of the North-South distinction. I'm quoting, "It is, I think, fair to suggest that all local northern groups represented at this inquiry are rapidly developing a common frustration that many important decisions directly affecting the future of all Northerners are being made or will be made elsewhere than in the North and by people other than Northerners. Yet it will be us, the Northerners, who will be left behind after all is said and done to salvage our lands, our communities, and our personal lifestyles." The third issue, of course, is white versus native rights. Here, another relevant quote, more relevant to this question, is from the submission to the same Berger inquiry by the Indian Brotherhood and Métis Association of the Northwest Territories. I'll make only a small quote. "We urge upon this inquiry the view that the construction of a pipeline, or of any other major development, for that matter, prior to the completion of a land claim settlement will have an intolerably prejudicial effect on negotiations. It is impossible to negotiate fairly over your land if the steam shovels are digging up your backyard. Our thesis," I'm continuing the quote, "no pipeline before a land claim settlement is more than just a request designed to protect our bargaining position. It is the formal expression of a more fundamental issue which will be before this inquiry. The issue is one which involves the struggle between two opposing concepts of economic development of the North. The pipeline proposal represents the colonial philosophy of development. Opposed to this notion of northern development is the community philosophy of development as exemplified by the native land claim." The third issue is development versus the environment. This is an issue, of course, that's faced in many other arenas than the North. One of the complications is that it's easier to establish guidelines for environmental control than it is to ensure that those same guidelines are met. In particular, the mere establishing of baseline studies and controls over the environment and watching to see that those controls are met themselves have real costs, not just financial, but environmental. In this respect, there's a cartoon, courtesy of the Environment Protection Board, that was reprinted in the CARC newsletter of two birds sitting in a tree in the middle of the summer. They're surrounded by cameras and microphones. One turns to the other and says, "When you're up to your arse in biologists, it's hard to remember that we came to the Arctic to copulate." And one could quite sympathize with the birds if they couldn't tell the difference between a biologist and a pipeline builder. The fifth issue, centralization versus decentralization of activity and decision making. Part of that harks back to the example I gave from the Northwest Territories Council of Municipalities. I'll refer more to it below. The sixth, Canadian versus continental trade and energy policies. The seventh, foreign versus domestic ownership and control of the oil and gas industry. These two factors have led, with other ones, to the formation recently of the Public Petroleum Association of Canada, of which you will probably hear more in the future. All three of the last issues that I mentioned are exemplified in part by the first part of this submission by the Foothills pipeline to the Berger inquiry when that inquiry opened. I'll quote some of that. "Mr. Commissioner," this is recalled by the council for the Foothills pipeline proposal, which is planning an all-Canadian pipeline to service Canadian markets. "Mr. Commissioner, let us first recognize that the Canadian Arctic Gas Project," the opposing project, "is not designed to meet Canadian needs. I don't have the Toronto sophistication, so I form my conclusions by the usual process of simple logic. I took the Canadian Arctic Gas affiliated companies, written and verbal statements, and did some arithmetic. I found a 48-inch pipeline with an economic operating capacity of 4.5 billion cubic feet, running from Prudhoe Bay across Yukon and the Northwest Territories to Trevelyan Lake Junction. I found a 48-inch pipeline with a similar economic operating capacity of 4.5 billion cubic feet per day coming down from the Delta and joining there. I added these two together and found that their total capacity is 9 billion cubic feet per day. I then went to the affiliate's filings and looked to see what was happening south of the 49th parallel. For the Canadian Arctic gas portion is just a link in this gigantic system. South of the 49th parallel, I found running from Kingsgate, British Columbia, two new 42-inch pipelines, each with an economic operating capacity of 2.25 billion cubic feet per day. When I added those two together, I got 4.5. I then went to the east and found running south from Mounchie, Saskatchewan, a new 48-inch pipeline with a capacity of 4.5 billion cubic feet per day. If you add all of these volumes crossing the 49th parallel, they come to 9 billion cubic feet per day, the same amount that is going to come together if the pipelines operate at capacity at the Northern Junction. It seemed to me a reasonable conclusion that if everything that comes in at the north must go out at the south. I asked the Canadian Arctic Gas representative about this on the witness stand in another place, and he told me that was coincidence. Now I ask, should we accept that? Or might we be a little skeptical and conclude that in line with pipeline economics, which says that lines must be operated at capacity in order to keep unit costs down, that in a very short time, everything which comes in at the north, indeed, must go out at the south. In other words, that this system, as drawn on the map, clearly and demonstrably intends that Delta gas will go into export. The eighth issue is that of present versus future generations. That is a very broad issue. An example I can give for you, which spans not just that issue, but others, was found in the Labor Day message, which I'll quote from again, which the Roman Catholics bishops distributed on Labor Sunday. I'll give you only a small quote. Based on the ethical principles of social justice and responsible stewardship, we believe that the following conditions must be met before any final decisions are made to proceed with specific projects for northern development. One, sufficient public discussion and debate about proposed projects. Two, achievement of a just land settlement with the native peoples, including hunting, fishing, and trapping rights and fair royalties. Three, effective participation by the native peoples. Four, adequate measures to protect the terrain. Five, adequate controls to, and this is the one that's really relevant to the last point, adequate controls to regulate the extraction of energy resources from the north to prevent the rapid depletion of oil, gas, and other resources which are non-renewable. Until we as a society begin to change our lifestyles based on wealth and comfort, until we begin to change the profit-oriented priorities of our industrial system, we will continue placing exorbitant demands on the limited supplies of energy in the north and end up exploiting the people of the north in order to get those resources. That quotation is unique not so much for what it says, but from where it comes. I'm giving it to you as evidence of the kind of changes that are underway, that a group of that sort should feel called upon to make that kind of statement to all their members. Finally, number nine, there are a number of sub-issues relating to the methods whereby public and private decisions are made. First is participatory democracy. Remember that? The second is public information rights. And the third, confrontation versus consensus. And the fourth, very similar, adversarial versus cooperative decision processes. A lot of that was part of the bishop's focus in their address. Also, these procedural questions, the deep underlying ones, are much of the focus of the Canadian Arctic Resources Committee, whose document I have been quoting from, and which one really ought to join, an association one ought to join, if one wishes to keep up to date with these issues, because their newsletters do contain a lot of background material that otherwise would be unavailable. Well, a number of the issues I've mentioned are general enough in all contemporary industrial societies. Others are peculiar to the Canadian scene. Each is worth a lecture in itself, but perhaps you might say not by me, and certainly not tonight. I'm going to spend my time now setting the stage for my yet-to-come and dizzying charts. First, I ought to really admit that there are far too many potential Arctic pipeline proposals to keep track of, so I will not deal with them all. I shall largely ignore the Alyeska or TAPS pipeline presently under construction to carry oil from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, Alaska for shipment by tanker down the Pacific coast and offloading in Washington and California. I'll also largely ignore the El Paso proposal to transport Alaskan gas over the same route for liquefaction at Valdez and tanker shipment to California. When my notes were being typed out and the version came back, the El Paso proposal was referred to as the El Pass proposal. I realized at once that that was a mistake, because everyone realizes that El Pass is a strategy in Spanish poker. The third polar gas, the project that I will ignore, is the polar gas project, which is lying rather quietly in the wings, waiting to come forward to transport gas from the Arctic islands of Canada to southern markets in both Canada and the United States, possibly linking with a cross line from the Mackenzie Delta if the other lines do not go through. Instead, I'll concentrate on the two competing proposals to build a natural gas pipeline from the Mackenzie Delta. Of all the projects in the planning stage, this proposal, or these two proposals, are the best known, because, of course, they're the subject of the Berger Inquiry under the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs. They're the subject of hearings at this present time before. Is the sound loud enough?
Yeah. Here. Can you hear back there?
Yeah. Hearings before the U.S. Federal Power Commission, and they are to become the centerpiece in a five-stage hearing before the National Energy Board, which starts on October 24th, this coming Friday. There are two competing proposals. One is from Canadian Arctic Gas Pipelines Limited, a consortium that wants to build a 48-inch line carrying Alaskan and Canadian gas to southern Canadian and U.S. markets. The other is the so-called Maple Leaf Project, comprising a 42-inch pipeline from the Mackenzie Delta to the northern border of the provinces, and expansions of the Alberta Gas Trunk Line and West Coast Transmission Lines in Alberta and British Columbia. Both projects envisage carrying about 2 billion cubic feet per day of Mackenzie Delta gas to Canadian markets. In their submissions to the National Energy Board, both groups argue that frontier gas is needed as soon as possible for Canadian use. And the National Energy Board has agreed in its recent report entitled Canadian Natural Gas Supply and Requirements, released in July of this year. This question of need, which lies beyond the terms of reference of the Berger Inquiry, and on which the National Energy Board has already reached its conclusion, is central to the Arctic pipeline issue. It may well be the case that the decision to proceed on a Mackenzie Valley pipeline will be foreshortened by a possible U.S. preference for the Canadian route for Alaskan gas, a preference that will be conditional on the Canadians offering immediate approval to the CAGPO, or Arctic gas proposal, and providing guarantees that Canada would not attempt, by taxation or other means, to appropriate a share of the cost savings provided by the Canadian route for Alaskan gas. Such a situation may well arise within the next 6 months. If it does, then the federal government would have to either accept the CAGPO proposal without following the full course of public hearings, and certainly without settlement of native land claims, or else by default accept the Foothills project or risk a possible substantial deferral of Arctic development. Even without this possibility of impending U.S. pressure for a hasty decision, the broadly perceived impression of gas shortage is likely to encourage a shortening of the decision process. This suggests the first goal for academic research: to place the current views in their historical context and to assess their accuracy from an independent viewpoint. Our research on this matter in the Department of Economics at UBC extends back to 1972-73. Nothing ever starts in a single year at a university. Everything always starts in an academic year, during which we held an interdisciplinary seminar on the topic under the joint sponsorship of the Economics Department and the Division of Continuing Education. Part of the eventual outcome of that seminar was the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, Arctic Gas and Canadian Energy Policy, published by McClelland and Stewart in 1974 and edited by Peter Pierce. in which faculty, students, and others collaborated in the analysis of the only proposal that was extant at that time. That seminar also raised something in our level of consciousness higher than it had been before, and that is the extraordinary value of policy-related research as part of the teaching program. We found in groups of undergraduates and graduates engaged in this research a far higher level of motivation and contribution to original research than we as teachers, I myself at least, thought we had any right to expect. And a quality of result was obtained that was far superior to that obtained from normal teaching methods. The book itself remains remarkably durable, despite its advanced age of 18 months. Which, as you will realize, in the rapidly evolving energy situation, is a very long time. At the time, the proposal we assessed involved export of most or all of the Delta gas, and our study suggested that the terms and conditions envisaged by the proposal offered little in the way of net benefits to Canadians. Furthermore, we could find no evidence of need for the Arctic gas for Canadian use until the late 1980s. Since those studies, the proposal has altered to remove the emphasis on exports, and the National Energy Board has held hearings and published reports on the supply of and requirements for crude oil and natural gas. It was the natural gas supply hearings and the NEB report based on them that provide the documentary evidence and analysis of natural gas shortage. To put the 1975 National Energy Board report into historical context, we must first see how the National Energy Board and the industry perceived the supply and demand situation as we entered the 1970s. Figure 1 shows the NEB view of the future, seen from 1969. With domestic demand and exports both rising steadily throughout the 1970s and 1980s, all provided from non-frontier regions. On the basis of this view of supply, the NEB in 1970 approved new export commitments totaling almost 6 trillion cubic feet, an increase of 50% in the total amount of gas committed to future export. And I might add, 150% of the total amount of gas that's been found in proven form in the Mackenzie Delta. No export contracts have been approved since 1970, so that the stock of remaining export commitments has been reduced to less than 14 trillion cubic feet, with annual flows that are roughly constant until 1980, and then decline. As shown in the lower line. You can see that the flow of exports envisaged by existing contracts and also the quantity of non-frontier exports envisaged by the next 69 report were of approximately similar size in 1974, but show a continuing decline from now on as the existing contracts run out. The NEB report of 1969 showed exports growing from about 1.1 trillion cubic feet per year in 1975 to more than 1.5 trillion cubic feet per year in 19.
Can people see that at the back, or should they move forward?
Can you see that at the back? Apparently so. In sharp contrast with the 1969 report, the board's 1975 report concludes that non-frontier supply is already inadequate to meet current demand, plus existing export commitments, and in 1985 will cease to be adequate at this point to meet even domestic demand, assuming no exports. Between 1969 and 1975, the board has substantially reduced its estimates of supply and increased its estimates of demand. Under normal circumstances, this would be puzzling enough. But an economist is especially perplexed when he notes that the NEB in 1975 is envisaging far higher relative prices for natural gas, even relative to crude oil, than it did in 1969. Our next step is to unfasten the Marshallian scissors of supply and demand, hopefully not forgetting how to put them back together again, and see what the supply situation and the demand situation look like compared between the two reports. Turning first to supply, still from non-frontier sources, we find that the two views are not very different in their implications until about 1975. Thereafter, they diverge sharply. The NEB in 1975 now assumes that the non-frontier region contains ultimate reserves of about 114 trillion cubic feet. In 1969, the NEB didn't talk about what the ultimate reserves available for hooking up in the non-frontier regions were, but the most optimistic reports publicly available from official sources, as in the 1972-1973 Energy Mines and Resources Green Paper, indicated about 200 trillion cubic feet. I've shown here the supply that would be forthcoming if those reserves were hooked up as required to follow the NEB's 1969 view of demand and availability of exports. And that line drops off sharply at the time when the 200 trillion cubic feet have all been hooked up. Note that if we only had 114 trillion cubic feet, as the NEB is now forecasting, this line could nevertheless continue following up that steep path until 1989. Then it would start a deep, steep descent after the 114 trillion cubic feet were hooked up. The key issue in all of this is exactly why the NEB's 1975 line is dropping off as fast as it is, even given the reduction that has been made in the estimate of the total amount of non-frontier resources to be developed. In the course of the NEB's gas supply hearings, we prepared an analysis of all the pool-by-pool studies of the deliverability of gas from non-frontier areas. This analysis showed that almost any of the submitted forecasts of non-frontier demand could be met from non-frontier sources of supply until the middle or late 1980s, given modest exploration and development efforts and contracting of available, uncommitted non-frontier gas. This result was in sharp contrast to the conclusions of the submitters whose data we used. Our results were widely branded by some as unrealistic ivory tower analysis, reflecting only our lack of knowledge of the structure and workings of the industry. To us, and especially to me as the direct participant in the hearings, it seemed only sensible to consider all existing non-frontier reserves as available for use, so long as they can be developed at less than the frontier costs, where the relevant frontier costs, of course, include Mackenzie Valley pipeline transportation costs of 70 cents per 1,000 cubic feet or more. Our studies indicated non-frontier sufficiency even at normal rates of flow from reserves. However, one of the most useful reports submitted to the 1975 NEB hearings was a pool-by-pool analysis by McDaniel, who discovered in almost all of the pools studied that the new higher wellhead prices make faster extraction rates more profitable than the traditional ones. For example, in 95% of the pools studied, doubling the annual rate of extraction from 5% to 10% of initial reserves increased the profitability of the operation of the pool, even accounting for the additional investment required in compression facilities and development drilling. These possibilities for profitably faster production have not been incorporated directly into our analysis, but they obviously provide a very important safety valve if supply turns out to be forthcoming less fast than thought possible, or demand to increase faster than expected. The reactions of industry participants and of the board itself to the McDaniel study provides a useful example of how unanimity of view can be used to replace quality of analysis when the proceedings are not subject to independent scrutiny. One cross-examiner criticized the McDaniel study for using only a 15% pre-tax rate of return on capital when deciding how many new wells to drill. The argument was picked up time and again by counsel for many parties, repeated in final argument, and reported by the board in its final report as though it were a clinching reason for ignoring the evidence that faster extraction is more profitable. If any of these advocates had thought about the matter for a while, or had gone back to the original study to check the results, they would have found that their point was backwards. In general, the higher cost of capital, the greater the advantage of faster extraction. And that is what McDaniel's results showed, for he did assessments at three different discount rates, ranging from 6% to 20%. And the higher the discount rate, the more profitable it was to extract faster. This example reminds me of an old New Yorker cartoon, and it's an example that illustrates how unanimity of view and understanding can lead one to ignore rather straightforward evidence of two ostriches standing talking to one another in the desert. They weren't alone in the desert. The horizon was almost filled with ostriches. The only difference between these two and all the rest of the ostriches was that all the rest had their heads in the sand. The one ostrich with head removed turned to the other and said, "I wonder where everyone is today." Another criticism of McDaniel's study was that it showed that a large number of new wells could profitably be drilled. Too large a number, said the critics, to be feasible, given the stock of available drilling rigs. Here, too, there was evidence of a point being made and gratefully accepted and used by those who held a common view and were impatient with evidence of a contrary nature. The lesson, of course, by the way, should be heeded by us all. If McDaniel's study were redone using a higher cost of drilling, as one would expect to find if indeed there were a shortage of drilling rigs, then a smaller number of wells would be indicated. The same would happen if a higher cost of capital was assumed. As a rough check on the importance of extra drilling, I went back to his 60-pool study and found that the bulk of the drilling was in two shallow and relatively unproductive pools. If they were eliminated entirely from drilling and from accelerated production, the total McDaniel results would be scarcely altered, and the pace of development drilling would be well below historical and current levels of drilling activity. Other factors were noted that might restrict our availability to expand non-frontier production, ranging from a shortage of gathering systems, those are the small lines that go out into the gas fields, and processing plants, to the possible Alberta unwillingness to permit additional exports to the rest of Canada. These points have more real substance than the others, but analysis of them suggests that they're either temporary or surmountable. Turning at last to consider the demand blade of the scissors, we find a considerable range of forecasts of future demand growth. With the NEB now forecasting a much higher rate of demand growth than they did in 1969. Despite the assumption now of prices several times as high as those apparently justifying the 1969 forecasts, the 1975 NEB forecast is higher than the average of those submitted to the NEB during the hearings, although far less than the astonishing demand growth path being forecast by the Canadian Petroleum Association. Of all the demand forecasts submitted to the NEB, only that of British Petroleum took direct account of the effect that higher energy prices would have on the growth of demand. but their consequently much lower demand forecast was not included in the board's report, and I don't have it there. At the time of the NEB hearings, our empirical research was focused on supply, and we merely used the range of demand estimates submitted to the board by others to show that non-frontier sources could meet Canadian requirements through most of the 1980s with almost any of the demand forecasts. More recently, a group of students, some of whom are here tonight and all of whom are intensely valuable in this research, has been extending our analysis to include conventional non-frontier oil supplies, synthetic oil from the Athabasca oil sands, and demand for energy. So far, we have developed equations explaining the total demand for energy in Canada, but have not yet dealt properly with the split among fuels. However, to give you some flavor, at least, of these results, we've adapted our total demand equation to forecast the demand for natural gas, on the assumption that natural gas and crude oil would keep their share of total energy demand, despite their much higher relative prices, and that natural gas would even gain in its share of total energy, and would be used to service many new demands in Quebec to an amount reaching 100 billion cubic feet per year by 1980, equivalent, that amount, to about 20% of the capacity of the 250,000 barrel per day oil pipeline extension that is now being built to Montreal. Figure 5 shows that the NEB's 1975 forecast would still be on the high side even if energy prices had not risen above their relative 1972 levels. The higher green line shows what energy demand would look like from the equation if we fixed energy prices at the values they had in 1972 relative to other prices in the economy. Why is this? In part, it's because the NEB and the Canadian Petroleum Association and others are extrapolating growth rates from the 1960s, when energy prices were dropping relative to other prices, so that leaving them constant relative to other prices, of course, makes them higher and cuts growth rates below what they were during the historical 1960 period. Therefore, our equation forecast with fixed relative energy prices shows a lower rate of growth than during the 1960s. Our forecast for fixed energy prices is indeed higher than the NEB made in 1969, at which time they also didn't think that energy prices would be rising dramatically. Primarily because our estimate now includes an estimate made by the National Energy Board in their 1975 hearings of all new natural gas demand for Alberta petrochemical production, and also a full supplementary addition that I already mentioned to the Quebec market. And that explains almost the entire difference between our estimate with fixed prices and the NEB's 1969 estimate of demand. So the 1969 forecast gets reasonable marks for consistency, if not for accuracy, because of course the prices we're seeing now are not the prices of 1972. What happens if we use our equation to forecast the consequence of the almost trebling of city gate relative energy prices between 1972 and 1976? Sorry, 1979. We haven't traced them all through yet. This trebling, which we foresee, merely traces through the oil and gas price assumptions being made by the National Energy Board and the Canadian Petroleum Association in making their own forecasts. We make no allowance for an increase in the relative costs of coal and primary electricity, although those costs are likely to increase. This almost doubling of relative energy prices between 72 and 76 is more or less history, assuming that the provinces finally do accept the $8 per barrel wellhead price for oil and the $1.25 per thousand cubic feet price for gas at the Toronto city gates. Incidentally, we residential customers who are already paying much more than that may wonder what it takes to get to live at the city gates, where gas is so much cheaper. The answer is that you must live in a large factory with a gluttonous appetite for energy. The regulated utilities still have not learned that their rate schedules that charge lower prices for larger use are backwards in these new times where it is the gas itself that is valuable. The further increase in relative energy prices between 1976 and 1979 takes place as crude oil prices are raised to a world price estimated at $12.1976, maintained thereafter in real terms. There is a $2 per MCF price of gas to match, bearing in mind that there are about 6,000 cubic feet of gas equivalent to one barrel of crude oil in terms of British thermal units. According to our estimated equation, which is based on 1961 to 72 demand for energy in Canada, the effects of changes in relative energy prices are felt over the three following years. Hence, it is 1982, about here, before the rate of growth of energy demand starts to rise once again at its trend rate. The band around the curve, in other words, the distance between the two yellow lines on either side of the main yellow line with black in the middle, involve our estimates of the degree of uncertainty about that forecast of demand. It is one of the advantages of using statistical methods to estimate demand equations is that those methods themselves give you some measure of how uncertain you are about that estimate. The upper line and the lower line bound 95% of the probability of the price effect on the demand for natural gas. We can see that this line, even this line here, the higher of the two, which involves a price elasticity of about minus 0.35, that almost any allowance for the influence of energy prices on energy demand gives rise to a forecast of demand growth that's substantially below the NEB's recent forecasts. If our estimated demand series is combined with a supply series based on normal rates of flow, from all past and new reserves, as shown in this figure, then a deficit from non-frontier sources is not indicated until the late 1990s, by which time the 114 trillion cubic feet of ultimate non-frontier reserves have not all been used up, but they have indeed all been hooked up. To separate the effects of the NEB's low 1975 estimates of supply and their high estimates of demand, I've prepared a figure showing what happens if one uses the NEB's current supply estimate, which, as I've argued, is unduly pessimistic, and combined it with a demand estimate from our equation, assuming some responsiveness of energy demand to the higher prices. Once again, there is no pressing need for frontier gas. A small deficit appears in 1987, and it becomes substantial about 1990. Thus, our latest analysis indicates that the 1975 NEB report appears to exaggerate the potential shortages of non-frontier gas by both understating supply and overstating demand. In 1969, the errors were apparently the other way around, but if anything, smaller in magnitude, at least for the period prior to 1985. Hence my conclusion that the industry and the NEB alike have swung from over-optimism to over-pessimism about the quantity and costs of non-frontier natural gas. The conclusion from all of this is not that the Arctic does not have a real energy potential, and not that there would be a huge economic loss if it were developed before it were really needed for Canadian use. The key conclusion, in my view, is that we must not use a false sense of urgent need to foreshorten and indeed to disembowel the decision and planning processes. There is no doubt that it will take time to show due concern for the environment, for native land claims, for the changing underlying attitudes towards conservation, growth, and bigness, and for the very processes and methods of decision-making in the public interest. Finally, what can be said about the role of university research in all of this? It's been suggested by some that the influence of academic research, in the present case, has been to raise the level of the debate and of the analysis of Arctic pipeline issues, both inside and outside public hearings. Others have been more inclined to view the work as meddling in serious matters whose realities cannot be understood by the academics, with the result that irrelevant issues are raised and precious time wasted, thus increasing the difficulty of industry's job in bringing new energy supplies to Canadians. What is probably agreed by all parties, however, is that if independent academic research on such issues is to be effective and useful, it requires a different balance of efforts and skills than we usually employ. The research must be kept up to date with the latest developments and with the latest problems. Otherwise, and also with the latest theoretical developments. Otherwise, the results are likely to be dismissed, sometimes correctly, as being irrelevant and outdated. Even if they are current and accurate, academic results that are inconvenient for the government and industry participants can simply be ignored, unless academics themselves take the time and the trouble to spell out the analysis in public with sufficient clarity that the points must be answered. If such a process is to be effective, it requires a broader and more active public interest. An audience that demands documentation and analysis in place of rhetoric. Thanks in large part to groups like this, and to increasing awareness by the universities, and especially by the media, I think there's some reason to be hopeful about the university's ability to contribute to the resolution of public issues.
We have quite a bit of time for questions, and I'm sure there are many.
Government putting on the Canadian government to make a favorable decision with respect to the Arctic gas pipeline. That is very difficult to say. There are two competing U.S. positions about the pipeline. It is clear that California has an interest, and Alaska may have an interest in the project that takes the gas from the North Slope of Alaska across Alaska, liquefies it, and takes it down to the California markets. The Midwest United States, on the other hand, realizes that its gas needs are more likely to be met at lesser cost if the gas comes down through Canada. So there's a regional difference of view in the United States. There's also a large nationalistic element that says one must not trust American gas in Canadian hands for fear of the awful things that might happen there. And indeed the BC situation with respect to this export price of natural gas is used quite often within the FPC hearings as argument by the El Paso group that it would be very dangerous to allow that gas to enter Canada. Opposing those two views, which generally favor the El Paso project over the line going through Canada, there is the fact that the cost of bringing the gas via the Canadian route is likely to be substantially less. There are estimates that range in the area of 30 cents per thousand cubic feet less because of the high cost of liquefaction and transshipment in Alaska and California. It's generally felt that the cost pressures will override, but not by a monstrous margin. So the conclusion from that would be that the American pressure is likely to be of a sort that says, make a decision now. Whatever it is, it must be made now, because they will want to move ahead with one project or the other. If I'm right in thinking that the balance between the two projects in the American eyes is not very heavily weighted in favor of the transport through Canada, then it doesn't make any sense for the Americans to put a lot of muscle into twisting Canada's arm to favor the Canadian route. But naturally, they would put a lot of muscle on Canada to force Canada to make an early decision. Which, by default, of course, would be in favor of Foothills.
Yes.
Will the Berger Commission be able to have the Indian land claims bear more influence on the decision?
Can't hear.
Did you hear the question?
Yes. So,
will you repeat the question, John?
The question is, will the Berger Commission's findings make it possible for the Indian land claims to be dealt with sooner than they otherwise would? I doubt that. My suspicion is that the Berger Inquiry report will say a number of things about environmental matters and will make its strongest point that the Indian land claims must be settled before a pipeline goes ahead. But that view is generally felt by the native groups anyway, and the government is being encouraged to proceed quickly in its dealing on the land claims anyway, so it's not clear that the Berger report itself will aid and increase the speed with which the government proceeds. The Berger Commission, having not studied the question of the need for the pipeline, is not able in its conclusion to try and balance the Canadian need for the pipeline against the need for settling the land claims before anything is done. So by its very nature, the report will have to be unbalanced. I've been asked to make some comments on the concept of net energy in the formation of energy supply and demand forecasts. For those of you who are not familiar with the term, the concept of net energy is used sometimes in the assessment of energy projects to ask if one looks at all the direct and indirect energy inputs to a project that is supposed to produce energy and subtracts them, then one can measure net energy as what energy is achieved net from the project after subtracting the energy inputs. Our analysis tends to focus instead not on the net energy, but on the total costs of the project. And of course, energy is just one component of those costs. It would follow that any project that did not pass a positive net energy contribution, clearly could not pass a test that forces all of its costs to be covered. So in some sense, the stringency of the kind of economic analysis that's done is tighter than that just requires of a project that's supposed to produce energy, that in fact it does produce some. Yes, I've been asked to be more specific about what kinds of energy is used in the production of frontier energy relative to non-frontier sources. Well, the one easy statistic to quote, and that is that approximately 10% of the gas that's extracted in the Arctic would be used in the direct transmission process down to the non-frontier regions. So there's, a 10% energy loss off the top. To actually do the energy accounting for all the physical inputs into that pipeline is, of course, a very tricky and difficult job. I'm not convinced that that's the best way to do the bookkeeping, so I have not done it, and I have not seen the results of any attempt to do so. The extraction and transportation of natural gas uses a lot of physical capital, but itself doesn't use vast amounts of energy. There's a slight contrast to be drawn there with the oil sands, where in fact the processing itself takes a higher fraction of the energy that's the original oil sand than you'd find in the case of extraction and shipping of natural gas. I've been asked if the 10% loss in the line in bringing the Arctic gas to the south is taken into account in the various demand projections, and the answer is yes, in a sense that it's only the amount of gas that gets to the southern end of the pipeline that's regarded as playing a role in meeting the non-frontier requirements. I'm being asked if I underwrite the proposal that all energy demands of the scale and level that we presently undertake are justifiable and ought to be met. I think it's implicit in the demand forecasts we made showing the effects of much higher energy prices that if we were at all sensible in our choices, even as sensible as we have been in the past, which is not very sensible, there would be a sharp reduction in our rates of growth of energy demand. And you would see evidence of behavior that you would regard as being less wasteful of energy. Because, of course, the person who is trying to use his money in a fairly cunning way in the past was becoming increasingly more wasteful of energy because it was increasingly cheap relative to the other claims on his time and attention, while now it is becoming relatively dear. So that, in fact, conservation is starting to pay for those who worry only about how much something pays. So you'll find a lot of conservation-type activities underway. One of my colleagues assures me that he has reduced, through a moderate amount of insulation and thermostat fiddling, his annual oil consumption from 1,900 to 1,100 gallons per year. Well, if that kind of thing happens very often, then clearly it's evidence of less wasteful behavior in the terms that you're describing, and it's also the evidence of the higher prices really showing up in terms of the demand for energy. I'm asked if we take account of the fact that 10% of energy exports from Canada to the United States is used for military purposes. Essentially, we take exports in our projections as merely contracted amounts for shipment across the border, regardless of the purpose for which they're used. It's clear that somebody who is making a judgment, as indeed judgments are now being made, as to whether those existing export contracts should be honored, whether they should be cut back more or less relative to Canadian demands, if a shortfall should indeed come to pass and be large in size, then the people making those decisions are clearly going to ask themselves how important is that gas to the people who use it. Now, one then it gets driven to the particular users of that gas. And indeed, you'd probably find that the bulk of the Canadian natural gas exports indeed don't go into weapons factories, but does go into heating of houses in the Pacific Northwest and California.
I want to ask in somewhat the same connection whether if the Mackenzie pipeline were built as a joint Canadian-American project, there would be any danger to Canadian sovereignty involved in war.
I've been asked to speculate about the consequences of a joint U.S.-Canadian project for Canadians if the U.S. became involved in a war. I find the whole future of major war involvement, clearly very much offshore wars have no very direct impact, as I can see it, on how one would manage and operate a pipeline through Canada for, in part, Alaskan gas. If something very much larger and much closer to us started, I just am not in a position to forecast what kind of things would happen. If very extreme situations came to pass, then it's very clear that all past contracts and all past bets and all past arrangements would be off, and that would probably be true on both sides or all sides of these kinds of arrangements. The general point that's being made is that joint projects involve a lessening of sovereignty, and that is quite true. One cannot make deals of any sort without constraining one's own future path of action. The important thing to remember is take account of those constraints when making those arrangements. Don't rule out necessarily mutually advantageous arrangements simply because it does involve constraining your own future course of action, but by all means take it into account when you're deciding whether the deal is a good one. The key difference between Foothills and Arctic Gas is that the Arctic Gas proposal is irrevocably tied to the transshipment of Alaskan gas. Indeed, of course, that's what distinguishes it from the Foothills proposal. I foresee there becoming an immediate crunch in that decision within the next year or so. Suppose that didn't happen. It is then nevertheless a possibility that 10 years from now, there would be enough Alaskan gas for two pipelines, one across Alaska and another one down through Canada. So there might be a new version of an Arctic gas proposal coming forward, which would then be considered vis-a-vis a Foothills proposal. The big advantage that the Foothills proposal has is that being focused on Canadian needs, once the basic underlying strategy were approved, conditioned on need, then when the need came with a sufficient lead time, then that project could be started based purely on the Canadian needs. And that is obviously an advantage it will have, because if the Canadian need arises at a time when the Americans aren't otherwise planning a new pipeline to get their Alaskan gas out, then clearly a Canadian-only project will be the logical starter. There's a one further advantage that perhaps I ought to mention of the Foothills relative to the other one. It's possible, and statements have been made in Alberta to this effect, that if there were some undertaking that Arctic gas could be tied in to the Alberta system at a time that system was starting to drop off in its deliverability from fields to Albertans and others, then Alberta might be more inclined to relax their own export restrictions vis-a-vis exports from Alberta and use the Albertan supplies to provide for Canadian needs for a longer period of time. In other words, the deal of using more Alberta gas now with some guarantee of supply from frontier sources is more adaptable to the Foothills plan because it ties in with the existing Alberta pipeline system than is the Arctic gas proposal.
The biggest oil and gas reserves seem to go up and down like a yo-yo. How much do we trust these figures given by the company?
Well, a good part of the question was, the oil and gas reserve figure seems to go up and down like a yo-yo. How much can we trust them? Well, a simple answer that academics always use is that if something is moving back and forth very fast, you look at the midpoint. That's too simple a conclusion. The suspicion must arise in these cases that these forecasts are being made in order to produce a certain decision. There is quite a close relationship between the interests of the parties making the forecasts in 1969, their interests in expanding exports, therefore in assuring lots of supply. There's lots of supply for Canada, therefore enough to commit an extra 6 trillion cubic feet for export, and indeed that was done in 1970. Conversely, in 1975, we have an industry interest in showing that the domestic non-frontier supply is insufficient. Therefore, much better terms and conditions need to be provided to the industry in non-frontier sources and full access granted to the frontier. It's quite clear there's that association of interests with the nature of the forecasts. That, of course, exposes to me the need to go into the guts of those forecasts in some detail and use what is technically solid in them and smoothing out what appear to be gratuitous assumptions brought in for no very strong reason. The question asked, if the CAGPO line goes because Canada isn't prepared to make a decision fast enough and we come to foothills by default, is there enough gas in the Delta at present and in near prospect to fuel such a line? The first point to make is to remind you that both proposals planned to use the same amount of Canadian gas, so that in general, if there is a supply shortage vis-a-vis the Mackenzie Delta, it applies to filling half a 48-inch line, which takes twice as much as a 42-inch line, and the 42-inch line is what Foothills are proposing. CAGPO argue that Foothills is more of a risk in this regard because the CAGPO line could always run half full of Alaskan gas, even if there were only a small amount of Canadian gas to add, while you'd have to get a substantial amount of Canadian gas to get any line off the ground at all from the Delta. Foothills argue that they could fully power their line with the existing stock of reserves. Now, it's a very small stock. I noted that only 4 trillion cubic feet had been proven up until the end of 1975. That is a very sharp reduction in what was expected 2 years ago. 2 years ago, there were very confident claims that between 10 and 15 trillion cubic feet were in proven form or would be before a submission was made. The first time there was an official report by a consulting firm made public as to what the actual quantity of proven reserves was, as opposed to probable and possible and so on, it was 2 years ago and it was 4 trillion cubic feet. That number has not gone up at all in the last 2 years of drilling. So I think you will find universally a real fear amongst those involved of the precise question you raised, that in fact the Arctic discoveries have proven increasingly unpromising in that Delta area, and that real questions would be raised in people's minds about proceeding with a pipeline now on straight Arctic supply reasons, which are quite independent of the reasons I've been talking about tonight. The proponents say they've got enough to start with, and that would then lead to enough new exploration that that supply would be forthcoming. I regard that as an expensive bet. The question is, in the light of cost estimates that have increased from somewhat over $2 to about $10 billion for various versions of a Mackenzie Valley pipeline over the last 4 to 5 years, what are the prospects of still further increases, and what is the overall cost likely to be? Is that a fair summary of the...
Well, I think there's an element of exploitation here that I was trying to get at.
The question as to who is exploiting whom, if it's expensive, the more expensive it is in real terms, then clearly anyone who uses it and has to pay for it, in some sense, is sorrier than he would have been had it been cheaper. The arrangements made by the proponents of these pipelines are that the users will bear all the costs of the pipeline, that it will not be have a tariff set by the regulatory board in the usual manner, but that the month-by-month costs will in fact be shared by the users according to how much gas they put through. They argue, I think with some justice, that that method is one that tends to keep pipeline down costs down relative to the usual regulated industry situation, where basically anything the regulated industry can get away with putting into its rate base and persuade the regulatory agency that it's a justified expenditure, they can get a guaranteed return on. If in fact the users of the pipelines are paying the cost directly, they'll want to keep the cost down. One of the reasons costs have escalated in expectation are, of course, because construction costs and prices generally have increased. My belief is that the latest estimates extent, measured as sums of current dollars, are still too low. Essentially, that they have not digested the rapid increases in construction costs over the last couple of years. There is an increasing tendency, and a wise one, on the part of those making the cost forecasts to put them in terms of constant dollars. In other words, they have priced the facilities on the basis of quotations at the present time, and then anybody who's making the decision can make their own escalation factors for the general increase in construction prices. The highest of the estimates you mentioned, $10 billion, the consortium will be quick to point out that that included, as it was before the FPC, that included the cost of all the U.S. facilities for that system and not just the Canadian facilities. The increase in the cost of the Canadian facilities by the Arctic Gas Consortium has been of the order of 20% to 25%. Since they first started quoting relatively hard costs in the latter part of 1974 and their most recent submissions in 1975. I do suspect that that 25% increase is not enough to cover the escalation in nominal costs that's gone on in the meantime. Either that or the Syncrude doubling of costs, which is now rumored to be more than that, is a real aberration. The question is, how can I compare a $10 billion pipeline with a much cheaper garrison diversion? And the answer is I can't, because I don't have enough information. I'm sorry. The point you're making is, sooner or later, given the increasing costs of Arctic production, which is a consequence of the decreasing luck in exploration in those areas, if the pipeline costs themselves rise relative to other costs very much further, then the project eventually wouldn't be worth anything, even if there was enough gas up there to make it worthwhile. That possibility is there, but it will have to be assessed when the time comes.
Perhaps you can have one or two more questions over here.
All the demand forecasts were supposed to be, by all the submitters, were supposed to be their estimates of what the consumers in fact demanded at the prices those people were forecasting.
But did any consumers actually demand it?
The interesting thing about the role of consumers in all of this, if you look through all the submissions to the National Energy Board hearings on this, is that there is quite a large galaxy of industrial users, not the Consumers Association, who's tended to be more cynical about the proposal, but the industrial users have, in broad terms, said anything you can do to get us a larger and more secure supply of gas, the more we'll like it. My suspicion is that they haven't gone back and done their homework about how much demand they really, how much gas they really want when they see it at the new price, because they haven't yet seen gas at the price they would be getting it for. The question is, if the Foothills project goes ahead and its cost has to be raised, the $10 billion was mentioned, the Foothills project is not in that region, call it $4 to $5 in terms of today's dollars. What effect would that have on the foreign exchange rate for Canada and in general the economic balance of the country? We spent quite a lot of time in 1972-73 assessing the macroeconomic effects of the proposal at that time. We are in the process now of doing a particular comparison of Foothills compared to Arctic gas. The general distinction between them in terms of their macroeconomic effects is that the Foothills proposal plans to use more Canadian content of goods and of capital, but both projects proposed to have more or less a balance in terms of the foreign goods they would use and the foreign capital they would use. In that case, there is not a strong direct effect of such a project on the foreign exchange rate. You may remember, harking back 2 or 3 years, that there was a lot of discussion about a pipeline driving the value of the Canadian dollar way up and then throwing the forest industry out of business, that kind of discussion. That kind of discussion focused on the effect of a large capital inflow on the value of the Canadian dollar. What it did not take adequate account of was, in fact, that a large project of this sort has a large direct import content, too. And if the initial import content is more or less the same size as the capital account item that's matching it, then there's no immediate direct impact on the foreign exchange rate. The macroeconomic effects of a construction job of that sort would be more or less the same as they would be for any large localized construction project where the pressures are very large, very close to the event, the location of impact, and then grow gradually less as you spread out from the construction industry to the other industries. But no doubt, with very large projects, those effects are big enough to be watched very carefully.
Perhaps one last question over here.
I'm just wondering if you've made any special effort to inform the Northern public of your findings.
I think in general, the question was, have we made any special effort to inform the Northern public of our findings? My guess is that the Northern readership of this Mackenzie Valley Pipeline book on a per capita basis probably runs 50 or 100 times its readership in Southern Canada. In general, the degree of awareness in the north of these issues is very much higher, in part thanks to the CBC, which has played, again, a unique role. It's part of this changing mosaic of how these issues developed. In fact, they are doing a very high level of broadcasting in many languages of the Berger Inquiry hearing, so that, admittedly, that's not on the kind of study that we are doing, but it does spread a much wider awareness of the pipeline issue. I have spoken to high school students from all over Canada in Yellowknife in the presence of some Northerners. That's the only direct contact we've had with Northerners. My guess is they find out about these things more or less as other people do, but with a higher level of interest.
I'm going to ask another expert on resources, Professor Milton Moore, to thank the speaker on your behalf.
Our speaker's colleagues in the Department of Economics have grown accustomed to enjoying his dazzling performances whenever he makes a presentation to a seminar. whether it be that he is leading us through his computer model, where he traces all the effects on the Canadian economy of a large project such as the an Arctic pipeline, or whether it be the effects on foreign exchange rate and capital markets and the value of the Canadian dollar, and whatever it may be, of intricate changes in the Canadian tax structure. But it is not just, and also, as you have seen tonight, he is an extremely formidable opponent whenever it comes to debate or discussion. Although I still think, John, that I have been right once or twice. I have yet to win a debate with him or even score a point. And I suspect that none of the council who cross-examined our speaker in his several appearances before the National Energy Board were ever able to score a point either. It is not just in performances such as that, however, that he obviously possesses a formidable fluency. He can take an audience who do not want to converse in the stilted language of the economist through a mass of complex material and lay bare the nubs of the issue. And it is for just such a performance that I wish to thank him tonight on your behalf.
Next week we have Professor Ruth Hodgkinson, who's speaking on progress in medicine, a social history. Professor Hodgkinson is perhaps the world's expert on socialized medicine in Britain.